So I'm 23, and I'm wildly underemployed. I was working at the Baltimore Science Center as a Segway operator. I taught 9-year-old children how to ride Segways for $12 an hour. That was my job. It was highly part-time, and I loved it. I was living with my friend JD. We lived in a Patterson Park row house. It was about this wide. You could, like, touch both walls. And we had, like, oodles of free time, and we'd spend our time getting drunk and just obsessing about various, you know, aspects of popular culture. We got obsessed with this film called Phantom of the Paradise. It is a 1974 Brian De Palma movie. Anybody seen it here? Curious couple? All right. It's a really weird movie. It's like a mashup of the story of Faust, Phantom of the Opera, Picture of Dorian Gray, all mashed together with Paul Williams of the Carpenters, Rainbow Connection fame. It's about Paul Williams is the devil, and it's about sort of like all this excessive rock and roll. Like he's opening a rock and roll palace called the Paradise. And it's a really weird movie. Highly recommend. One of my favorite movies of all time. We became obsessed with this movie. We'd watch it every Saturday night religiously. Our friend Matt the Dong would come over, and he would just like talk endlessly about the characters and how all the characters are terrible, but that's what makes the movie great. And we became obsessed with this movie. JD and I decided we were going to put this movie on stage. We had no experience doing so. We did not understand what it would take, but we were like, we see it. We want this to be on stage. We want the film, Phantom of the Paradise, with a live rock and roll band. We'll put it on stage. It's going to be a big set spinning around like Les Miserables. It's going to be awesome. I'm kind of like, you know, we're getting, you know, really high on this idea. We're very excited about it. And, you know, I'm going to a lot of like parties and getting, you know, hammered with my friends at that time. And so I would go to this party and I'd be like, you know, hey, do you want to finance a rock opera? Is what I would say to people, because I thought that was like kind of a weird, like classy thing to do, and made me sound kind of mysterious and cool. And, I'm super broke, so I'm kind of looking around at my friends who are like have a little bit more money than me, and being like, they want to finance my rock opera idea. We're going to put Phantom of the Paradise on stage. So I went to my friend David Purcell, who's making $18 an hour, building models for his dad's architecture company, and I said, Dave, would you like to finance a rock opera? And Dave says, I'm already financing a rock opera. And I'm aghast, and he tells me that people that I knew kind of loosely, Dylan Kohler, Eli Brightberg Smith, Jared Margulies, had already started writing a rock opera where each of them, who all lived together in another tiny row house, but in Charles Village, were archmages and wizards and viziers for like a fantasy environment called Brotopia, and so I was like, mind blown. But I started to talk with them about it, and we kind of started trading ideas. We were all getting really jazzed up. We were going to see a lot of weird art at that time, like stuff that was going down at the Copycat. Wham City was putting on some really cool stuff. There was a Jurassic Park play that they put on once that was very inspiring. We had a couple of rap sessions, and then I went home, and a couple days later after this one party, I sent an email to all those guys, and I said, this will be the first meeting of the Baltimore Rock Opera Society, parentheses, bros. And just the emergence of that acronym and that energy of like, oh no, we're official, kind of really sparked something in all of our brains. We started getting together. We would get together once a week, and we'd just have these like very like beer-fueled but like extremely productive writing sessions where we were all really getting psyched up about putting like the biggest possible show that we could possibly put on stage, and we were trying to get it into a script. And so Dylan and JD would have their guitars out, and they'd be kind of like coming up with riffs, and like people would be shouting out lines. We'd be like, what if this happened? What if there was a monster that had six arms, and all he did all day was he sat in his cave of shred, and he was the entire band. He had six arms and was playing the drums, and he was playing the bass with two hands, and he was playing double guitar. And we're like, yeah, that's awesome. And then, you know, then you got to pull the giant guitar out of the stomach of the monster. And then that's the ultimate guitar you can use to slay the evil king, right? And, like, these kinds of ideas were just, they were flowing. It was like we were spinning gold. So we were, I was like, we would furiously take notes, and then I'd take it home. Me and maybe Jared would kind of, like, come up with, we'd flesh out the scenes in between writing sessions. And JD and Dylan would come up with some riffs and write a couple of songs. And eventually we got to a point where the script was done. And it was very confusing because now we were like, now what do we do? And we didn't really have a concept or an idea, but Eli and I went down to, God bless them, Red Emma's, when they were in Mount Vernon, who was at that time in control of the 2640 space. Now they've kind of separated, but the 2640 space is a beautiful burnout theater in Charles Village. Many of you have, I'm sure, been there. It's an amazing space. We convinced the anarchists to give us a contract for a month. Don't ask. Do not ask them to do this. Do not ask the 2640 Collective to do this these days. They will not oblige you, but we convinced them to write a contract for us, which was amazing. We just immediately started flyering out everywhere across the city that we could that said, we need you, stage manager, production designer, guy who can design sets, the guy who can make clothes, anybody who can help with anything, please come to our meeting at Dylan's house. We need your help. And I convinced my mom, who's here tonight, to make sets. Give it up for Vicky Keating. She built them out of cardboard at my behest. Thank you, Mom. We started rehearsing, just kind of figuring out as we went along. I remember at one point I went into me and JD's, our tiny Patterson Park row house, and I did not know this was happening. I did not know that we had a live band, but apparently we had a live band. There was a 6-piece live metal band playing, like, heavy, extraordinarily loud rock and roll in our living room. I could not actually get through. Brandon Wildman has a drum kit. You know, you've seen the drum kits where there's like a giant rack, right? It's not like this with the cymbals on little polite stands. It's like a giant rack with about 17 pieces of drums on it in my living room. And JD's like, check out our new song. And it's heavy metal and it rules. And it was kind of my first feeling of like, oh, this is actually completely out of my control. I'm not in charge. We are just all here just wildly creating together, and we just have to kind of channel it onto one thing that happens on stage. We moved into the 2640 space about 2 weeks before the show. Nothing is done. We have barely started any props or sets, except for my mom, who's really good at meeting deadlines. So she shows up, just like, when's the show? You know, There's stuff scattered all over the entire floor of the 2640 space. Just people just randomly making crafts, building guitars, that kind of thing. Dylan, who wrote many of the songs in the first show, was like building a guitar one day and he was cutting out some cardboard with a box cutter. We were like, don't look at it. Do not look at it, Dylan. He chopped his thumb really big, and then they took him to the hospital, put some pressure on it, and he got set up in a cast that was shaped like this. So So he did not play guitar in the initial show, but he was very positive the entire run of the show. He helped run ticketing. Dylan's awesome. You know, I remember, you know, just going out into the back little parking lot behind the 2640 space. There's like a little grass parking lot, and our friend Jono was like nobody had built the monster yet, the giant six-armed monster. And so Jono's like figuring it out. He's like braining this thing hard. He's got this big hoop skirt thing with fabric on it, and he's like spray painting it wildly while there's like a windstorm going on. Because he's really like, we opened in the next week. Nobody's figured this monster out. He's like spray painting, and it's just there was tons of people who just showed up that I didn't know their names. I didn't know who they were, but they were like, how do I help? And that was like this incredible feeling where just all these people were like, saw that we had this vision. We wanted to make the biggest, craziest rock and roll theater show that had ever existed on planet Earth, and we just told people, come help. And holy cow, they really did. And they started showing up, there was just an incredible amount of craft and a lot of fear and anxiety constantly that we would just try to kind of tamp it down. We coined the phrase onward to glory. That's what we would say to each other. Onward to glory was kind of what you would tell yourself when you needed a little boost, is that we're doing this for like a bigger cause. The cause is the greatest art piece of rock and roll theater that's ever existed in Baltimore or the entire universe. And lo and behold, Grundlehammer happened. We had an amazing time. We sold out 3 shows, which was the entire run of the show. We were not expecting people to show up, but like this kind of like amazing groundswell of like we're exactly where we're supposed to be happened in that moment. We put on the show called Grundlehammer, we found that glory, right? We found all these people together with 200 people in, you know, 250 people in the 2640 space and another 50 people backstage just trying to make this whole, like, jalopy kind of get over the finish line every single night. And it was the greatest feeling that we've ever had. Today, Baltimore Rock Opera Society, I was executive director for 15 years. Today, Baltimore Rock Opera Society is still doing that exact same thing. And twice a year, you can show up, any of you can show up to pitch a show where you're like, what's the piece of art that belongs in this world that doesn't exist right now? What is the craziest idea that no one has had the courage or want, just nobody's been able to put together the pieces? All other art is dissatisfies me. How do I make the better piece of art for this world, this craziest piece of performance that I can possibly come up with? We take pitches twice a year. From you guys, from anybody who wants to show up and say, I've got a crazy idea, will you join me in doing it? And it was just the best feeling in the world for me to see, like, all of us, we had this crazy idea where we were like, let's make the most insane show we can happen. And we just jumped off the cliff with no rhyme or reason, no actual, like, good expectation that this would land in any positive way. And like 100 of my greatest friends showed up to catch all of us. And it was like, it's the best thing in the world. So come see a bro show. Thanks.